Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Shabbat Shalom. Of all the questions connected to tomorrow night's festival of Hanukkah, the most seemingly straightforward is, why is Hanukkah 8 nights? At first blush, the answer is simple. As the Talmud relates, having defeated our Greek oppressors, the Maccabees entered the temple of old to rededicate it, whereupon a single cruse of oil was found, enough for just one night. Be it due to the hand of God or the wonders of the fracking industry, the tiny oil reserve went the distance. 8 days, a miracle preserved in 8 nights and 8 lights. Straightforward as the explanation may be, as many a Hebrew school student has pointed out, but Rabbi, if there was enough oil for one night, then is a Hanukkah miracle really 8 nights, or is it actually 7? After all, the first night was no miracle. Why 8 nights? A question which, if you tug at it, sets in motion a whole series of other questions as to the origin and meaning of our upcoming beloved festival. One explanation I recall being given as a child was that the Maccabees carefully titrated the contents of their oil reserve over the course of 8 days, a policy that kept both the miracle alive and oil prices up, an elegant solution if there ever was one. One rabbinic explanation says it's not about the oil, but the 8 days required to be purified to re-enter the temple. Historically speaking, the most plausible answer is that upon re-entering the temple that winter, the Jewish community realized they had missed the 8-day fall festival of Sukkot. The first Hanukkah was really a belated Sukkot, as related in the second book of Maccabees, complete with lulavim, palm branches, and all the symbols and prayers of the missed festival. There are many answers to our question, but this morning I want to share with you a thought that comes by way of Dina Weiss, the Rosh Beit HaMidrash of Hadar, egalitarian yeshiva on the west side. In a comment on this week's Torah reading, Weiss reflects that when people are faced with a daunting and difficult task, it's only natural that they find themselves either unable or unwilling to take action. The problem is so big, so insurmountable, in difficulty, in volume, in complexity, that rather than leaning in, stepping forward, and chipping away at the task before us, we stand paralyzed, immobilized, or we step away entirely. It happens to all of us. It could be preparing for a bar bat mitzvah. It could be handing in all those college applications. It could be a project at work or even in the synagogue. It could be the public square, the environment, the rise of anti-Semitism, the soaring costs of college education, or even Jewish education. Depending on who you are, your issue will be different. But the shared human experience is one and the same. Overwhelmed by the enormity of the problem, we do the calculation in our head. We determine that whatever effort or contribution we would make would be meaningless. So we shrug our shoulders and we do nothing. All of which, I imagine, is precisely how Judah Maccabee and his band of brothers felt when they entered that defiled, dishonored, and derelict temple on that cold December Jerusalem day so many years ago. Exhausted, diminished in number, and perhaps even depleted in faith, they stood there staring at the enormity of the task before them. Could the temple be rebuilt? Could it once again house God's presence? They had won the battle, but not the war. Why build it at all if the Greeks were just going to inflict destruction once again? The scene would be an amazing one to stage or to film. There were those who were broken, those who said, why bother, those who were arguing in that corner, pointing fingers, and probably those who just told themselves and others, this is just not my problem. And then it happened. And this is my movie, so I am going to cast Emily and Harris as the starring roles. At the edge of the frame, they spot the cruse of oil buried under some piece of trash. And while the elders are crying, arguing, and otherwise, they walk up to the front of the Holy of Holies and they pour the oil into the Ner Tamid, the eternal light. And they say the Shema, or maybe just give each other a fist pump. The eternal light begins to flicker, at first unsure of itself, until one of the Maccabees notices and stops his weeping and begins to pick up trash. And then two Maccabees, who were arguing over whose fault it all was, see the person cleaning up and they stop arguing and they start to pitch in. And then the flame begins to shine a little more brightly and a little more. And then as more and more people start pitching in, a little more. And I haven't yet picked the soundtrack, maybe Springsteen, maybe John Williams. The camera pulls back, and I promise you, by the end of the scene, there's not a dry eye in the house. It's altogether human, in the face of the insurmountable, to wonder what one can possibly do. The miracle of Hanukkah is that in the face of the impossible, they lit that flame. And the message to this day is that as long as we have life to live and breath to breathe, inaction is never an option. As Weiss explains, the rabbis of old were well aware of the challenge of insurmountable problems, two such examples being illness and poverty. In the case of illness, the Talmud teaches that to visit the sick at best can only remove 1/60th of a person's suffering. So too, when it comes to poverty and hunger, we may well wonder what our small contribution can make. Nevertheless, the Talmud explains, the ancient Israelite farmer was obligated to allocate 1/60th of the field to the poor to glean. There are other examples, but the message is clear and given its most pithy expression in the words of Rabbi Tarfon in Pirkei Avot, you are not obliged to finish the work, so too you are not free to desist from it. 1/60th is not a lot. In fact, if you know a bit about the Talmud, then you know that it's rabbinic code for saying a negligible amount. And yet we stand obligated to do our 1/60th, to not desist from the task at hand. The 500 or so Thanksgiving meals delivered by the Park Avenue Teen Food Pantry last week. An extraordinary effort worthy of praise, but in the effort of the 1.3 million New York City residents with insufficient food, including 1 in 5 children and 1 in 10 seniors, it's not even 1/60th, not even a drop in the bucket, but we do it, and we do it proudly. Because, as the Talmud teaches, mitzvah goreret mitzvah, one mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. If we give our 1/60th, then maybe another church, another synagogue, another mosque will give their 1/60th, and then that person at the law firm or the foundation will allocate their 1/60th to food instability, and then pretty soon all those 1/60ths will add up, and even then the problem may not be solved, but it will be better. And better, though not perfect, is still good. Not on this issue, not on any issue, do we desist from the task, because we know that moral leadership is measured not by what others are or aren't doing, but by what we choose to do or not do. In the words of Gandhi, to be the change you want to see in this world. Yes, it is true, according to Maimonides, that theologically speaking, the balance of the entire world rests on the deeds of a single person. But for the less theologically minded, we're not so certain whether our deeds will or won't tip the balance. But that fact of not knowing our impact, or not knowing whether we will ultimately be successful, has never been the Jewish mark of moral leadership. Lest we forget, when Abraham went toe-to-toe with God defending Sodom and Gomorrah, he failed. His heroic stature, though, was never contingent on the success of his mission. Rather, it was secured because he stood up for what was right and for what he believed in. None of us can say whether our small contributions in deed, in personal capital, or actual capital will make the difference in the face of the daunting issues of our day. But we do, nevertheless, engage. This week, I forced myself to do what I normally would not do, to read about the National Climate Assessment Report, a report filled with warnings of the dire consequences of climate change if significant steps are not taken to rein in global warming. It is a lot, it is complicated, it is scary, and truth be told, I am not exactly sure what my role is and where to begin. But I dare not enable, I dare not ignore, and I dare not turn away. I am deeply proud that my dear colleague, Rabbi Witkowski, is leading the charge here in the community as to how PAS can be a leader in this effort as an institution and as a hub to inspire our membership families to contribute their own 1/60th, as it were, towards addressing our environmental crisis. As a rabbi, I know I walk modestly, knowing that much in this world is not in our hands, but in the heavens. I also believe that the Lord helps those who help themselves, or as I overheard this week, I do my best, Hashem does the rest. On this issue, amongst others, I look forward to the synagogue being the best we are capable of being, and I would ask you to reach out to Rabbi Witkowski if you too would like to get involved. And I would be remiss, if I didn't mention that more often than not, there is no environment more toxic, more seemingly insurmountable than our own family systems. It could be a relationship that went off track, a family member who was a friend who was like family, and now after so much he said, she said, so many knots to untangle that frankly, it's just easier not to deal and get swallowed up in that emotional quicksand. What difference will it make? I'm just going to get hurt again. Nobody really forgives anyone anyway, do they? That may be the case. But you know what? You'll never know until you try. As the saying goes, this world is full of lonely people waiting to make the first move. What is the story of Joseph and his brothers, if not the tale of one really complicated family that was able to rebuild trust step by step by step? Call me crazy, but whether it's that nasty person who lives on your elevator bank, or that old friend with whom you've had a falling out, or anyone for that matter, there is nothing as disarming and delightful as extending a warm hello, a small act of kindness, and maybe even an undeserved gesture of forgiveness. The worst that will happen is it will be ignored or rebuffed. The best that will happen is that it will be reciprocated, a risk-reward ratio that I can live with and would recommend to anyone. A final story, one that I've told many times in staff meetings, but never from the pulpit. The best training I ever had to be a congregational rabbi was decades ago when I was a unit head, a Rosh Eidah, at Camp Ramah in the Poconos. The then head of the camp was someone named Cheryl Magan, one of the outstanding Jewish professionals and educators of our time. She liked to have our meetings while walking around the camp's main lawn, the Migrash in Hebrew. And as we would walk and talk, every so often she would bend down. She would pick up a piece of trash, a wrapper, or a popsicle stick. Until we arrived at the trash can, she'd throw it all out until, of course, she found new trash. Towards the end of one summer, I finally asked her, even though I knew the answer without asking, why she did what she did. She was the director of the whole place. There was a maintenance crew to do what she was doing, and besides, she and I both knew that by the time of our next conversation, there would be more wrappers and more popsicle sticks on the Migrash. Her task would never be complete. and she explained to me her theory of leadership, that being a leader is not about the words we use, but the deeds we perform. As St. Francis of Assisi is said to have said, preach often, and sometimes use words. She picked up the trash because if she, the head of the whole camp, did it, not only might other staff, counselors, and campers do the same, but they would see themselves as caretakers of their community. She picked up the trash because while her acts were, in the grand scheme of things, insignificant, she had the choice as to whether to be part of the problem or part of the solution. And while she could not make right wrong, wrong right, change the past, or control the behavior of others, she could make sure that her behavior always represented her best self and her highest hopes for her institution. Finally, she said, she picks up the trash because it's the right thing to do. It costs her very little. And what sort of person walks by a piece of trash without picking it up? And ever since, that is how I try to live my life, run my rabbinate, and lead my synagogue. Friends, there is more pain, more darkness, and more trash in this world than any of us care to admit. Be it the environment, this city of ours, or our own families, we are all contributories, we are all stakeholders, and every one of us need to do our part. Every deed counts, taught Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Every word is power. Like the Maccabees of old, each one of us bears the potential to bring light to the darkness, hope to the cynicism, and be the person we aspire to be, inspiring others to follow our lead and mend this world in such desperate need of repair. Oil or no oil, at the end of the day, the eternal light is not up there. It is right here. This is the miracle of Hanukkah, the miracle of the Jewish people, the divine spark embedded in every human soul. And that light, it never goes out. So let's use our God-given spark and create miracles in our day, as did our ancestors of old. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, the place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul.